Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Mark Green, who talks about his new book that warns voters of the fascist threat posed by Donald Trump in this November's presidential election. Abigail Fuller of Maine Voices for Palestinian Rights, who discusses her group's successful campaign urging Portland, Maine City Council to pass a resolution divesting from companies complicit in Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. And Bob Sanders, a retired Jewish journalist from New Hampshire, who explains why he undertook a 650-mile bike ride to Washington, D.C. to build opposition to Israel's war in Gaza and raise funds for humanitarian aid for victims of the conflict. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In his final weeks in office, Mexico's popular president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, is pushing through controversial judicial reform legislation. The bill overhauling the judiciary cleared its first legislative hurdle on September 4th when Mexico's lower house passed the reform package despite protests by federal court employees, justices, and magistrates. The legislation must still be passed by a two-thirds vote in the Senate, where AMLO's Morena party is one seat shy of a supermajority. Under the reforms, judges would run for election instead of being nominated by the president and approved by the Senate. The legislation would also reduce the number of Supreme Court justices from 11 to 9 and cut their term limits from 15 to 12 years. AMLO has accused Mexico's Supreme Court of being corrupt, especially after it blocked several of his proposed policy changes. While critics warn the legislation will erode the judiciary's independence, AMLO argues that a direct popular vote for judges will make the courts more accountable to Mexican voters. President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum, a close ally of AMLO who will be sworn into office on October 1st, supports the judicial reforms. Germany's far-right Alternative for Deutschland Party, or AfD, is celebrating a historic victory in the eastern state of Thuringia, where it won almost a third of the vote, 9 points ahead of the nation's conservative party. This was the first time an extreme right-wing party has won in a state parliament election since the Nazis were in power during World War II. The AfD's Thuringia leader has used pro-Nazi rhetoric at his election rallies. The AfD, which also received the second highest vote total in the more populous neighboring state of Saxony, has little hope of forming a government in Thuringia because other parties are unlikely to work with it. The night's other big winner was the new left-wing conservative populist party, the BSW Alliance, which broke off from the far-left Linke Party last year. The BSW, which calls for higher taxes on the rich, curbs on immigration, and an end to military assistance for Ukraine, scored nearly 16% in Thuringia and almost 12% in Saxony. In a stinging rebuke from voters, Germany's ruling coalition, the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Free Democratic Party, each scored in the single digits. The landscape in rural Michigan is quickly changing as green energy investments are building large-scale wind and solar farms. Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer supported her party's legislative majority's passage of bills requiring utilities to generate 60% of electricity from wind, solar, or water sources by 2035. The legislation also gives the state final authority to override local zoning restrictions in order to site large-scale renewable energy projects. However, many rural communities objected to utility-scale renewable projects in their backyards, complaining the noise from wind turbines would disrupt their quality of life and reduce property values, despite studies disputing those claims. In some towns, local officials were recalled for supporting renewable projects. Kevin Martis, one of the leaders of the campaign against renewable energy, used tactics like bringing angry residents to disrupt public meetings, followed up by recalls, referenda, and threats of legal action. Critics accuse Martis of being on the payroll of fossil fuel companies. Barnraiser Media reports that utility companies are part of a bipartisan majority that backs strong renewable energy goals and didn't support a referendum that would have prevented the state from overriding local zoning codes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
With the first and possibly only debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris behind us, the candidates will be sprinting towards this November's election, now less than 2 months away. In his new book titled The Inflection Election, Democracy or Fascism in 2024, former New York City public advocate and author Mark Green compiles a long and well-documented list of Trump's authoritarian policies while in office, and what he pledges to do if re-elected. Beyond Trump's racist, xenophobic, homophobic, and misogynist rhetoric, the book details the former president's embrace of white supremacy, political violence, and anti-science conspiracy theories, which paints a frightening picture of our nation's future if the former reality TV show host wins back the White House. As the twice-impeached, four-time indicted convicted felon, liable for sexual assault, who incited a coup attempt, campaigns for re-election, he charges that any election result other than victory will be evidence of fraud in a rigged process. Just days before his debate with Kamala Harris, Trump posted threats to jail his adversaries for unscrupulous behavior if he wins the election. Here Green talks about his new book, which warns Americans that this November will be a choice between a party of progress and a party of dangerous extremism that may determine the path of American governance for generations.
Denial is a great psychological device. When a loved one dies, your girlfriend runs away with your best friend, and your car is skidding into a guardrail. How many of us say, I can't believe this is happening? All of us. Well, a large body of people called MAGA, I call them MAMA, for Make America a Monarchy Again, want, you know, the litany of racism and homophobia and lying and violence. Probably half of Trump's 45% say, bring it on. You can't reason someone into a conclusion they didn't reason themselves into in the first place. You can't reason them out of it. So I would guess that of the 46% that Trump won in both 2016 and 2020, probably half of them are hardcore and don't bother me with the facts. And they know all the bad things about him because we have scandal fatigue. There's so much bad stuff about him that people kind of shrug, and you've seen that. The other half, though, or about 25 points of his base are, you know, regular Republicans, what used to be regular Rockefeller Republicans, are reasonable people, but have been scared into thinking Democrats are some kind of communist party. And those are the people that have to be appealed to, not you or me.
Mark, in your book, you talk about your hesitancy to use the word fascist throughout your political career. But today, with all that's at stake, you feel obligated to label Donald Trump, as well as his Republican Party sycophants, as fascists, to bluntly warn the American voters the threat Trump poses to U.S. democratic institutions. Make the case for our listeners who maybe aren't convinced or haven't heard enough argument why you think Trump deservedly should be labeled a fascist.
he's admitted it. The point I made about denial is because we've never had, I mean, at the state level, Huey Long or local candidates, Father Coughlin in the 50s with a reach of 40 million radio listeners, they were obvious fascists. But in elected office, it's rare to non-existent. So people go, oh, come on, you're exaggerating. Well, he finally admitted after hours of interviews with Bob Woodward, look, the thing that guides me, that helps me win is, I shouldn't say this, I'm quoting now, fear. And so American president should lead by example, policy, emulation, autocrats. Dictators, fascists, call it what you will. This is something that Ronald Reagan and the both Bushes would not call conservative. He wants to scare people by coaxing violence. The Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh, 9 were killed. The killer quoted Trump's screeds about the southern border. Fascists control the military, threaten to use it against civilians, as Trump has done this week. That he wants to imprison his political opponents. Putin is many things. But when he's asked, oh, we in Russia support Kamala Harris, everyone laughs, in Russia and around the world, because he feels as a former spy that lying is simply another tool in the tool chest. Well, Trump will always lie to wriggle out of a corner. Who does he laud? Did he ever laud Trudeau? Or Macron, or Western leaders, he does not. And I'm saying what you know and your audience knows. He was, I love Kim. Putin is a genius. His favorite autocrat abroad is Orban. Well, if he's always admiring fascists and he promises to act like them, I'm glad for your show to, you know, reinforce and educate progressive Democrats. But what's essential is that people who go to sleep thinking that they're not racists, they don't like rapists, they don't like liars, have to realize what they're buying into. And we don't need 20% to flip from Trump to Harris. Of Trump's usual 45% based on 2016 and 2020, if 5 to 10% of them said, as Dick Cheney most famously did this week, as 90 corporate leaders like Mark Cuban did this week, like 200 former GOP ex-staff to Republican presidents did this week. He is the greatest danger in American history to our democracy. He doesn't like voting. How do I know? He says he'll follow the results if he wins, but he won't if he loses. It's not a very democratic spirit there.
That was Mark Green, former New York City public advocate and author. Learn more about his new book, The Inflection Election, Democracy or Fascism in 2024, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Israel's war in Gaza continues into its 12th month, more than 41,000 Palestinians have been killed, including over 16,000 children and 11,000 women. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has repeated his call for an immediate ceasefire, labeling the level of death and destruction in Gaza as unprecedented during his 7-year tenure. Violence is spreading across the Israeli-occupied West Bank, where Jewish settlers are attacking Palestinian families, forcefully taking over many properties. In a September 6 protest against settlement expansion near the West Bank town of Nablus, a 26-year-old woman, Aysenor Aygi, a dual Turkish-American citizen, was shot and killed by Israeli troops. While the war in Gaza has raged for almost a year, there's growing opposition to the Biden administration's unconditional support for Israel, which has sent billions of dollars worth of bombs and other weapons used against Gaza's civilian population. Opposition has taken many forms, including widespread protests on college campuses. On September 4th, Portland, Maine became the fourth U.S. city to adopt a resolution calling for divestment from corporations complicit in Israel's occupation and repression of the Palestinian people. Your reporter spoke with Abigail Fuller, co-chair of Maine Voices for Palestinian Rights, who describes her group's successful campaign that resulted in a unanimous 9-0 vote by members of Portland City Council in support of divestment.
Our resolution asks the city of Portland not to invest in companies that provide Israel with weapons and other military equipment used in Gaza, or that operate in and contribute to Israel's illegal settlements in the West Bank, or enable or profit from the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And we passed it because we're taxpayers. And we care where our money is invested, and we don't want to be complicit in the genocide in Gaza through our taxpayer money going to the city, which would then invest it in companies that are complicit. So that's the sort of the reasoning behind it. We have tried and tried and tried to get the federal government, like many people around the country have, to push Israel for a ceasefire or to stop ending arms to Israel, and that hasn't happened. So going to the municipal level seemed like the next logical step to us.
I don't know if I'd be inaccurate to say whatever investments the city of Portland, Maine has in Israel don't really amount to a great deal of money, and you could correct me if I'm wrong. So this appears to be more of a powerful symbol of the issue and the crisis in Gaza right now.
Primarily, we are, in fact, trying to have a really material effect on what's happening in Gaza. Yes, Portland is not a large city. It doesn't have a huge amount of funds to invest. But we're hoping that what we've done will happen all over the country. There are retirement funds in which people are calling for those to divest as well from Israel. There are people pushing, you know, banks to divest. And so we feel like we're a part of that. I mean, we alone, of course, are not going to make the difference, but we're part of a much larger movement that we feel really can have an effect on Israel.
If you could, give us a flavor of the debate that occurred at the city council chambers where members of your group and allies promoted passage of this resolution. And of course, there were some opponents of that resolution as well who spoke. What do you think carried the day that was a very lopsided, unanimous vote in favor of the resolution? Tell us a little bit about that debate.
Well, first of all, we did not go into that debate blind. We did an enormous amount of groundwork to bring the resolution to the city council and to ensure that it had the votes for passage. What we did is actually met individually with each city councilor. We reached out to them, had individual meetings with them. In most cases, we asked people we knew who also knew a particular city councilor to help us set up that meeting. We had discussions with them to explain what divestment was and why we were doing it. So we really did what some people call relational organizing with each and every city council member so that they understood what we were doing. We knew beforehand that we had the majority and that it was going to pass and probably even be unanimous because we had done all that groundwork. Well, yeah, there were a lot of differing views, obviously. I would say it was mostly civil, for sure. There were a lot of people on the pro-Israel anti-divestment side who said things like, this would make them feel safer. They've always felt welcome in Maine, and this is not going to make them feel welcome anymore. A lot of people just really felt like this divestment resolution takes sides, that the city council shouldn't be taking a stand, that it's not under the jurisdiction of the city council to take a stand. So there are all kind of arguments, all sorts of arguments like that. And on our side, the people who wanted the divestment resolution passed gave really heartfelt testimony about how heartsick we are to, you know, see photographs of dead children in Gaza, you know, virtually every day, to know that our government is enabling this to happen, that sort of thing. I should also say that even though a majority of the people speaking against divestment were from the Jewish community, we have a huge number of people in the main coalition for Palestine and in Jewish Voices for Peace, which is working for us, who are in favor of divestment. So we had a lot of especially young Jewish people standing up and saying, I am a proud Jewish American and I support this divestment proposal. So I would say, too, one of the key things is that early on, we knew that to try to combat the anti-Semitism that we'd be accused of, we wanted to make sure that we involved Jewish voices in our efforts, and we did that from the beginning.
That was Abigail Fuller, co-chair of Main Voices for Palestinian Rights. Learn more about the group's successful Portland divestment campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 24th, a 69-year-old retired Jewish journalist from New Hampshire set off on a 16-day, 650-mile bike ride from his home in Concord, New Hampshire, to Washington, D.C. The goal of his ride is to build opposition to Israel's war in Gaza and to meet with his U.S. senator to urge her to suspend unrestricted aid to Israel and free all hostages. The bike-riding journalist, Bob Sanders, founded a group of fellow Jews called Not In My Name New Hampshire. He's collecting signatures on two petitions, one specifically for Jews to sign, as he makes his way down the East Coast. He's also raising funds for humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza and anti-war organizing work in New Hampshire. Sanders is no stranger to activism. In high school, he protested the war in Vietnam and published an alternative newspaper. When the school tried to stop publication of his paper, he asked the ACLU to take them to court, and he won. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sanders about his bike ride to end Israel's war in Gaza as he rode through New Haven, Connecticut.
Not in my name. The point is to publicize the names of the people signing. These are people who want to speak out and go public against Israel because there's been a shame, a reluctance for Jews to speak out against this. And we're trying to overcome that by having people publicly come out so that, in a sense, like the gay community or back when women were talking about abortions and stuff like that, it's for a Jew to come out against Israel is a tough thing, at least and we want to try to reach more traditional Jews. The petition is just a petition. We're not publishing names or anything. We're just saying we got so many signatures.
And what does the petition say?
One is that suspending unrestricted aid to Israel. I would say that's the most important demand now. It's not the first, because in the beginning, the first was ceasefire and to free the hostages. By hostages, we say all hostages. And what I mean by that is including the people being held in indefinite detention by Israel. The second, we want humanitarian aid that will go through UNRWA, the UN agency on the ground that's been distributing this aid for years. And because we've been cutting off aid from that, we are contributing to the famine, and which will kill much more than the 40,000 people that Israel has already killed in this war and that we have funded. We're saying that we want an investigation of war crimes, both with Hamas and Israel, similar to what the World Court is doing. Obviously, are against any kind of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia. We don't want false charges of anti-Semitism to be used to try to suppress free speech and freeze the settlements, stop building settlements on the West Bank.
It's very interesting. It seems like you, in a small state with a small Jewish population that's more conservative than the Jewish population as a whole, that you've done an amazing job of getting Jews to go on the record. And the other thing that's different is that, you know, so many young Jews are so appalled by what Israel's doing and have come out and demonstrated and, you know, set up camps on campuses and stuff like that. But for an older demographic that you're part of, it is more unusual. So what kinds of conversations do you have with people who end up signing? Do you have to convince them, or did you just find people who really are like you, older people who are appalled?
It's been difficult. There's a big gap between, even among people who are opposed, between the young generation, much more enthusiastic. I started this group because I was trying to get a chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace in New Hampshire. Now, there is a chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace for Vermont, New Hampshire, but there's nobody in New Hampshire in it except for one person. So I thought, well, we should build that up. And so I talked to, I know a lot of Jews because I'm not very religious or into the organized Jewish community. But I know a lot of people who are Jewish, who are political, who are doing good things and fighting the fight. I reached out to them, and they really were against what Israel was doing, but they were not into joining Jewish Voice for Peace because the rhetoric, the enthusiasm, which can be good, it basically turned off a lot of Jews. And one is it either turned off them, or they felt that they couldn't reach out to other Jews like their peers, which are older, with that kind of rhetoric. They couldn't get people to join Jewish Voice of Peace. So that's why we decided to do the Not My Name, which became us independent group. And we had more success reaching out with that. So we don't use words like genocide or anti-Zionist, or we still don't want funding to go to slaughter people in the West Bank. I think people are okay with words like apartheid, but genocide to Jews is a very touchy subject. I say that I've gotten a lot of support during surprising amount of support and surprising little flack.
That was Bob Sanders, a retired Jewish journalist from New Hampshire, biking to Washington, D.C. to build opposition to Israel's war in Gaza. Learn more about the bike ride and his group, Not In My Name New Hampshire, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, KFUG in Crescent City, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.